welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my very special guests, Andy and Lizzie Manley, former members of New Frontiers. Andy, Lizzie, it's good to have you. So excited to do this. We've tried to connect, and you're in the UK, so it makes it a little bit difficult scheduling with my work schedule. So glad we were able to finally connect, and maybe we could start with you just telling the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Thank you, John. I asked Lizzie to start because Lizzie has a history with New Frontiers that goes back further than me, before we got married. So do you want to start with what you experienced when you were younger?
Yeah. Well, I became a Christian in Easter Monday 1981 and became a Christian at the age of about 17 and went straight into New Frontiers. And it all seemed really great at first. I really thought, like, with the worship and everything, I just was so impressed by the fact that people seemed to really mean their work, the worship. But then we started getting into the shepherding type thing, which I wasn't, you know, I didn't realise that, but what it was at the time. But it never occurred to me to disagree with people. But basically, they had this thing that if you were a single woman, you had to submit to your house group leader. And I never forget, I was working with some particularly disturbed under fives. And I would get home at night and sleep for an hour. And I know one, and I got volunteered onto the girls' club at the church. And when I wanted to give up the girls' club, they said maybe I should give up the play group and do God's work instead, which was one of the beginnings of the nails in the coffin to my faith, because I, in the end, I lost my faith for about 10 years. And it was tough, because now I'm coming to learn more about the roots of this organization and the history, partly from your broadcast on the seeing the history and seeing all the con artists that were involved in it. I can see now that me falling away wasn't actually me being stupid. It was my logic and the cognitive dissonance going on that was the reason that I fell away. But not being a relatively new Christian and not sort of lasting more than 5 years before I lost my faith, I didn't know anything else. I thought that was what God was like, and I didn't like him.
Yeah, that seems common with a lot of people that have reached out to me. The they think they're leaving God whenever they're in one of these movements, but it really comes down to the fact that they're leaving something that just feels uncomfortable and disgusting, and the way that the leadership is so controlling. One person told me, if God looks like this, I don't want God. And what they were saying is, because the leadership looks like this, I don't want the church, is actually what they were saying in its essence. And like you said, you find all these con artists in the trail of their history, and you have to wonder, why did they choose those specific men? I was talking to a person just yesterday, and we were going through some of the God's generals, and in the era that they chose for each one of these generals, there were actually some really good Christian individuals, Christian leaders, back during the same era. Why did they pick the bad guys instead of the good guys is the question. But you come to find out that there's this history of just deception, I guess is the best word for it. And then what it does, it continues a framework of deception in the groups. So when people leave the faith, they call it leaving the faith because what they understand to be the faith is all of this deception. And in fact, they just left the deception.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I did eventually come back to God. after about 10 years away and some really stupid life decisions. But yeah, I always blamed myself for falling away and thought I wasn't a good Christian. But now I'm seeing that actually the cognitive dissonance was just too much to bear in the end.
And the real problem for me, when you look at the deception, it seems as though it's all about the money. You have the deception, yeah. And then there's always the money drives. There's always some way in which they can better themselves, bigger churches, et cetera. Was that the case in the group that you were in?
Yeah, there was a big emphasis on tithing. We were robbing God if we didn't tithe. And my friend, she wasn't very well paid. And the government, this is in the 80s at the time, suddenly gave rich people a huge boost of money. And one guy in the church was boasting how much better off he was, like £30,000 a year. And she was in they didn't have a minimum wage then. She was in a really low paid job. And she just went through agonies trying to tithe. And she used to come round to me for dinner because she didn't have any food and couldn't afford to buy food. And in the end, she stopped tithing, but really beat herself up because of it. And that was one of the cognitive dissonance things, because to me, the church should be helping the poor. They shouldn't be demanding more money of them.
Exactly. Yeah. I've seen similar situations where people, and the real sad part is because I was on the upper tiers, I knew many of the ministers. The ministers were aware of the financial situation and yet would preach this tithing thing as though it was a heaven or hell issue. But they're seeing the people give money that they don't have to them and watching them suffer while they're living like kings. There is no expense spared for their meals, but they'll watch the people suffer. And I really don't know how they do it. I personally could not watch somebody suffer knowing that I'm the cause of their suffering.
I don't know how they sleep at night. I really don't.
So what was it that attracted you to this movement that you were in?
Well, the first thing was I'd had experience of church, but it was all very staid and I was young. It was all a bit boring. And for some reason, I picked up this idea that anyone in church was a hypocrite. And then I went to this church and the music was good and people were worshipping like they meant it. And I really felt like I'd found my spiritual home. I didn't realise that the music is often a tool to drag you in as well. And also everyone was really nice. They were so friendly and caring. And, you know, we still know people that are really lovely that are involved in this. And it's such a shame.
It is a shame. And I don't think it's nefarious, but many of the groups practice love bombing. Whenever somebody's not in the group and they're a potential convert, they will bomb them with love. And then once they get in, the love still exists because everybody's unhealthily close together in their minds and in their worship. But then when they leave, it's the opposite of a love bomb. Many times you receive a hate bomb.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember when I was talking to somebody, one of my house group leaders, and again, she's lovely, absolutely lovely. But when I said, I was having a bit of a doubt, this was before I completely fell away, and I said, you know, I might just have to leave the church. She said, well, you won't be able to come round here anymore. And I'm like, oh. And then you just sort of realise that you're sort of trapped in it.
Yeah, that's the truth. Whenever you're in one of these groups that practices the love bombing, I think the key of what you said, I don't know that I've ever articulated this, but one of the things that you mentioned is it looked like there were a bunch of hypocrites, so you didn't join the church. Well, what you're seeing is the manipulation. You see people who are acting in a way that humans don't usually act because they're being manipulated to act in that way. But cognitively, when you join the group, you realize internally that, hey, I'm acting the same way, and people outside think that I'm like this. So it makes it even harder to leave, because now you're forced to face the, I don't know what you call it, the mental consequences that you have joined something that other people is going to see as hypocritical. And it's, you can't really blame that on the church itself, the what's going through your mind as you're trying to leave, but it is yet a further tool for keeping people inside of the group. And I think to some extent the leaders realize this, because as you can see with what we have today, it seems like it gets more and more outlandish with time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how about you, Andy? What was your story in coming into New Frontiers?
Okay, well, Lizzie and I got married in 2004, and for a while we went to the Baptist church locally. We came across a new church that had opened up, which turned out to be New Frontiers, and we went along to that, and similar sort of thing, really. We liked the music, the people were very friendly, and we came along to it. One of the sort of red flags I should have spotted, really, is we were asked to go along to a kind of church induction course for becoming members and explaining what their theology was. And pretty soon on, I think it might have been the first week of that, we had quite a strict view of tithing given to us, which I immediately objected to, which probably made sure I was never invited to join any leadership of any sort. I was already kind of in their black books before I started, really. But it was quite nailed down. Interesting, I was looking at some information on New Frontiers yesterday, and I did hear their founder saying that he didn't want to nail down their theology with a mission statement, because he didn't want people to feel that they were in a kind of theological prison. But our experience was the exact opposite of that. The theology was absolutely nailed down. In fact, one funny story I can tell you about that is that one time New Frontiers had a theology forum, which you could register on online. And it was an interesting forum in that you weren't allowed to post your own views on it. And if you tried to email their apostles to clarify what they'd said or question them, they told you you can't do that because they're too busy to answer your emails. So it's the only forum I've ever come across anywhere where you're not actually allowed to express your views and the leaders won't actually answer you. So my experience was that the theology was very much nailed down. They were very big on tithing. The local churches would tithe 10% of what they made to the head organization, which at that time was quite unified. We started noticing some strange things as we were going along there. They wanted to know who was giving cash and how much they were giving, ostensibly because they wanted to reclaim the tax money on it, but it seemed a little bit prying that they needed to figure out who was giving what. And then after about a year, we suddenly got an apostle allocated to us. Now, you might think that the logical thing to do would be to allocate an apostle that was nearby or over a region, but it turned out that this apostle was initially in South Africa, and then he moved to Dubai. And then they started asking people to go across to Dubai at a cost of sort of £800 or £900 a trip for conferences to see the apostle. He would come over occasionally, but I just didn't understand the logic behind that. I mean, why would you have an apostle so far away when you had several in the UK that were very nearby? Why spend so much money on these endless conferences? But by then, we've been there for maybe a couple of years. And what you find is that gradually your friendships become more and more involved with the church, that there are so many meetings going on in the church that most of the people there don't really socialise very much outside of the church.
But then they have a go at you for not having any non-Christian friends.
Yeah, well, you can't win, can you, in that respect? So over time... you do get this view that, because they mix in prophecy with scripture, it's very easy for people to manipulate how you think and what you do. And the church itself and the church structure becomes kind of God-ordained in a way that you shouldn't question it. They did once have an article in one of their magazines which described rebellion against leadership as similar to witchcraft. I can't remember which scripture they plucked out of the air to try and back that one up. But it was trying to enforce this top-down driven theology of apostles, prophets, submit to your leaders, listen to our interpretation of the Bible. We did put some information up in the bookstore we had. That was removed because it wasn't New Frontier. So the books and the things that were advertised were their conferences with their books. We did find out who was earning what locally. I can look at their accounts. And I was quite surprised to see how much their ministers were paid relative to Anglican ministers. They were getting two or three times what they were paid. In terms of the people running the organization, it seemed to be much harder to find out who was getting paid what and where the money was going. I never did find out exactly what they were getting. I think one document seems to suggest that the people at the top would be getting something around £60,000, but it could have been more than that from more than one source.
Yeah, this was 20 years ago.
It was 20 years ago, so yeah. But, if I wanted to know, for example, in the Church of England, what the Archbishop of Canterbury earns, I can look it up and within 5 seconds I will know. I could never find that with New Frontiers. It was not that obvious. And that, again, is a red flag for me to not know where the money's going exactly. Now, I don't think the founders were living particularly lavish lifestyles, or I don't think it was on the sort of televangelist level of wealth by any means. But at the same time, personally, I would think it ought to be more transparent, people, not, especially if they're preaching tithing.
Yeah, the transparency is the biggest problem among all of these groups, because if they were transparent and people were to understand what's going on, they would be forced to reform, because the casual listener would not put up with a lot of the things that are happening behind the scenes. I've had numerous people contact me about New Frontiers. You weren't the first one. You're just the first one to be interviewed. But there are a number of people contacting me. They're all saying exactly what you're saying. They're talking about the spiritual abuse. And interestingly, I've not had the time yet to do it. I want to publish some information about it. But one of the people contacting me connected it directly to Paul Kane, who was William Branham's protege. And Paul Kane, as you know, he helped start the International House of Prayer, the cult that Mike Bickle and all the problems that's happening right now in that church, Paul Kane was a part of its creation. Could you talk a little bit about your knowledge of Paul Kane being part of the New Foundation or the New Frontiers Foundation?
I never came across him, but I read it. I read about it. He had a prophecy about it. And but that's all I know. He wasn't really involved in the early 80s. And by the way, I can't believe I did this whole thing twice. I fell away from God, went to Baptist Church, then went to New Frontiers again. What an idiot. But there we are.
Yeah, I think it was quite early on. I did come across it the other day on YouTube. You can hear the prophecy from Paul Kane given to the leader of New Frontiers at the time.
Was that Terry Virgo?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
I think it was quite early before they really got going. How much of an influence he had after that, I don't know. We weren't part of leadership in any way. As I said, I was already there's no chance of me ever being made a leader in there because I mean, my attitude to tithing was, well, you know, A, you're not a Levite, and if you were, you're only entitled to 10% of my food produce, which at that time was a few runner beans. So I don't mind giving you some money, but if I know where it's going. But as far as the tithe is concerned, I don't really think you want a biblical tithe if I take it literally. So I wasn't particularly popular for saying that. it is sad in a way. I mean, it's one of the most manipulative doctrines that's used, tithing, and it's unfortunate that people don't get to hear the truth that, that tithing wasn't for ministers of religion. It was for Levites, and they are not Levites. They are not doing festivals in the temple. They're not doing animal sacrifices, and they're not banned from owning land like Levites were. So the whole rationale for God saying that they had to give a tenth of their food produce to them was because the Levites didn't own land. Well, ministers in New Frontiers own houses, they own property. They're able to make money in other ways. St. Paul took a part-time job so that he wouldn't be a burden on believers. And this is something they forget, that if they're going to say they're apostles and they want to live like apostles, then why don't they take a part-time job and reduce the tithe and do what St. Paul did? I've never heard any of them say that. And yet that's absolutely biblical. That is what St. Paul did.
One thing that really got me doubting was when I found out that they started a food bank, which is fantastic. They, you know, it's really, it was really needed where we were, but they were making the food bank pay rent on the church, so they had to scrub the food bank. I was on the board of directors of it. We had to scrabble around trying to raise money to pay the manager and to get food when we needed it. But the reason they bought it into the building itself was to raise money for the church. And it's like, no, you shouldn't be doing that. You should just be feeding the poor.
I call it creative accounting. They find ways to skirt the main accounting so that they can offload some of it to other entities, and all they're doing is basically moving money from here to there so it looks differently. But it's just the whole thing. You mentioned the tithing problem. For me, the bigger problem is if you read the Old Covenant tithing system, like you said, it wasn't to make one man rich like they're doing. But even worse than that, the priest gave a large portion, almost all of it, back to the people at, on the year of the Jubilee. It wasn't at all intended for them to, you know, to better themselves. It was literally a way in which they could help the people ration their food and their land and their livestock so that they could survive. It was more of a survival technique than it was anything.
It's like social security.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's not taught by them at all. It just goes into this black hole of ministry funding, and if you don't know where it's going or how it's being spent, it makes it very, very difficult to justify it. As I said, I think there are far worse people who preach this and really do live a very lavish lifestyle. I wouldn't accuse New Frontiers leadership of doing that. I've not seen any evidence of that, but in terms of the transparency, it could have been a lot better. I mean, in terms of whether they're a cult or not, I would say they probably aren't, but they have cult-like tendencies, and some of the things that they have going on could be very bad depending on who the local leader is. So they're a little bit more, they're a little bit less top-driven than they used to be. Since the founder stepped down, they now seem to be a little bit more autonomous. So that could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on who you have as your apostle and how they interpret things. But unlike the Baptists and the Church of England here, who have a voting system of members that is a bit of a check on anybody who's a rogue leader, they don't seem to have that, or they didn't when we were there. It was an informal sort of, well, do you agree with what we're doing or not agree with what you're doing? And the final straw for us was when we had a family meeting to decide how some of the money was going to be spent on training people and who was employed. And because there had been some disagreement about how it was being organised, we were told that we were not going to have a say, any of us, in the meeting. It was going to be the pastor only, and that it's not a democracy, it is a theocracy. And so we were going to be told what the decisions were.
But the other thing with that is that when you come to God, you have the Holy Spirit, so you can talk to God yourself. You don't have to go through anybody. That's why we don't need a temple and a high priest anymore. And But that went by the board. It was like, we have to submit to our elders and just do as we're told, even when it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And then in a way, they've created a system that is ripe for people who are narcissistic or abusers to exploit, because some of these individuals are very manipulative and are very good at using a system like that to manipulate others. And I wouldn't say that was necessarily the case where we were. There may have been a bit of that going on, but in terms of a safeguarding and a system that's robust against those individuals getting into powers of leadership, I don't think it was good enough. I think that a system where you have more say from the membership makes it harder for narcissistic individuals to get into positions of power and then to control and manipulate others for financial gain.
If you do a Google search on New Frontiers and you try to find any information linking it to the New Apostolic Reformation, if it's out there, it's very minimal. There are no real connections. However, the structure of how they've organized their church matches exactly what the NAR has adopted. And here you find Paul Kane, who's helping to promote it. Now, I know Paul Kane was instrumental in the creation of some of these and other churches, but you don't find a whole lot of information about his influence on this specific church group. However, you find that he is given the prophecy and that the leader's connected. So was there more to it? I don't know. But I can see that it's problematic what they've created. The structure is, like you said, it helps. Whenever a person has ill intent when they get into power, it helps keep them in power. And the missing transparency is really the framework that keeps them up in control of the people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, when you're in New Frontiers, you're influenced by all the people on God TV as well. So, this thing about having faith and the idea that you have to bind the devil and do all this spiritual stuff and God won't act on anything unless you pray. And it gives you this huge sense of responsibility for everything that actually isn't yours to have. It's God's.
Yeah. There's a lot of pressure put on people to volunteer and to perform and to spend an awful lot of their time sort of working for the organization of the church, and it becomes something that's sort of regarded as a divinely appointed structure that you can't criticize, that you have to slot into and you have to volunteer and give your time to, and then more meetings and more time and more money. The irony in this is that in terms of actually going out and evangelizing, they didn't really do very much of it. Most of the conferences would have been attended by people from their own denomination. They rarely went out and spoke to people who weren't Christians, from my experience. And most of the people that came into the denomination were Christians from other denominations that maybe wanted a more lively service in terms of the music or more charismatic, something like that. So they tended to draw people in from other churches rather than actually evangelize, which maybe was a good thing in retrospect.
It's really so odd because the word apostle just simply means someone who carries the message, somebody who is sent out to spread the gospel. None of these men that have this structure that we're talking about, none of them do this, but they call themselves apostle. And what they tell you as apostle is that they are to spiritually govern you. In other words, they're the platoon leaders. So you have this array of platoon leaders and you're in their platoon, none of which is biblical. It doesn't make sense that they're doing it. And I, even whenever I was in the movement that we escaped, I knew that the Bible had a different meaning, but I never really critically thought about why these people are doing it. I think if the transparency had have been there and people had have, if critical thinking was supported and promoted, which it should be, I think people would have never even adopted this because it's anti-biblical what they're doing. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
I didn't realize how many belief systems that I'd sort of absorbed that I still had. And I'm gradually, that's why I found your interview with, was it Adam Short?
It was Adam Short, yeah. And I actually have a meeting scheduled with him. He was in so many different NAR groups. I didn't realize it when I first spoke with him, but we've continued speaking, and he's going to be on a few more that we have. So we'll get more information from him.
Yeah, it was so interesting the way he was talking about having to deconstruct his faith and put it back together again, because again, backed up by God TV, I was believing that I had to have faith and for my healing. And I remember saying to Andy, I hate the word faith because I don't know how to fit myself into the shape of faith that they demand so that I can set everything off and get healed, which is basically putting the emphasis on works and me doing stuff to get God to heal me, which isn't that a spell where you have to do a certain set of things to get something to happen?
It is, but it's even more than that. When they teach the concept of faith in these movements, what they're actually teaching is blind faith. People, humans, can have faith and they can believe something, but the belief usually produces a tangible result. And that's why there is faith. You believe something and something will happen and then it does. But what these ministers and evangelists and apostles promote is the idea that you can have faith and nothing will happen, but you must believe that it did happen even though you can see no tangible result. In other words, you can have blind faith.
Yeah, I mean, I felt really bad. If I had to fill a form in and list, you know, and actually write down all the things. I used to feel really worried that I would never be healed because I'd written down that I've got asthma and, you know, and stuff like that. And it was like I didn't have enough faith because I was admitting that I had it. It's a horrible place to be.
It's horrible. I have family members who have chronic illnesses, and in fact, some of them have died from the chronic illnesses. And throughout their entire life, as they have this thing, they are just like you. If they even mention it in a casual conversation, they'll stop themselves immediately. No, I didn't mean to say that. Lord, please forgive me for saying it. Even though they have this condition, and again, it all goes back to the blind faith. They want you to believe in something that doesn't exist.
And then you get into the conference thing, because you go to the conference and you get on a bit of a high with the worship and you feel like God's presence is there. And then you feel like each time you go to a conference, you'll go up a bit in your faith, and then maybe you'll get healed from that. So you get caught into this trap of going off to conferences, and it is just like this hamster wheel. And as I've been gradually deconstructing my faith and getting more and more into God's word, it feels like this weight is just being lifted off my shoulders. And I can just go, it's all right, Lord, I just trust you.
It's freeing. Whenever you leave this thing and you understand that, number one, they were manipulating you. Number two, the so-called religion that they had wasn't really Christianity. I think that was the biggest concept for me to grasp. I thought I was a Christian. I thought it was in a Christian movement, but it wasn't Christianity. And when you step away, what Adam described well, the process of deconstruction, some people, when they leave, they try to hold on to certain aspects of what they believe because of pride. I couldn't have adopted something that was entirely false, so I must have adopted something that was partially false, and it tricked me. And so they try to replace just certain aspects of what it is they believe, not realizing that the whole foundation itself was wrong. And it isn't until you can deconstruct, literally come to the point where you become afraid that you have become an atheist because you have completely eradicated a false God. I believed in this God. I no longer believe in this God. Therefore, I must be an atheist. After you do this, then you can suddenly come to terms with the fact that, wait a minute, I didn't deconstruct God. I deconstructed this fake God that they had given me.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to the one we went to, I don't think they push the healing theology as far as expecting everybody to get healed. I mean, our pastor wasn't well, and he just said, well, we don't understand why. And it was more the influence of Andrew Womack and some of the televangelists that we were exposed to, I think, that would have pushed that more.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But again, the thing that kind of did it for us with them was that when we went to their meetings, their spouses would be ill and weren't healed. And you know, if you really had the power to heal people, wouldn't you start with the people that are closest to you?
Yeah, because of course we went to the Andrew Womack conferences as well, so that was all It all meshes together, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I didn't want to blame New Frontiers for that one, because I don't think they pushed that theology, but that's more through the God TV televangelist stuff that we were exposed to. But yeah, you see a kind of unreality about what's going on. I mean, I remember one meeting I was in with Andrew Womack, where somebody was obviously very ill. They had to call an ambulance, and the ambulance took him out. And it was almost as if Andrew Womack just ignored it, as if nothing had happened. And you think, well, if you're saying you've got the power to heal people and to do these things, why aren't you getting in there and helping this guy? And my problem with it is that I guess I'm not a cessationist in some ways, but you've got to at least admit where you can't say that you have a gift to go around healing the sick if you're not demonstrating it, either with people that are close to you or when there are people in the audience severely ill or things like that, and you're making quite a bit of money out of selling your materials, conferences and other things. It just seems to me a bit dishonest in a way. You're pushing a theology on people that is they're expecting to have to do X, Y, and Z to get healed, and then you're making money out of it. That seems to me wrong.
I really had the question, who is it that they're robbing? It's almost as though they're robbing God, because when they're doing this thing that they do, you go to these conventions, there are people who come to the conventions believing in God, and there are people who improve. But in many cases, whenever somebody improves, especially the fantastic cases, these are the people who are called up as examples that these people got healed in my meeting, therefore associate their healing to me. In other words, it's my fault they got healed. I have the power to make God heal them, is in essence what, if you follow all paths out to its logical conclusion, that's what they're pushing. And what they're doing is robbing the glory from God. And what happens is the people who see this, who are in the meetings, and especially the people that they claim as healed people, they connect their healing to the person. And over time, what happens is they connect their faith to that person. I know a really good close friend of mine, he will not miss a Benny Hinn conference. Whenever Benny Hinn is in any nearby town, he goes and he swears up and down that Benny Hinn has the power of God. Well, he has associated God with Benny Hinn. And, you know, I'm not saying Benny Hinn is not a Christian. I can't answer that question. But I can say that what he's doing is deceptive. And I just don't believe in my heart that God would be deceptive like this.
Yeah, we did go to one Benny Hinn meeting in London, which, as it happened, due to a visa mix-up, Benny Hinn actually couldn't attend. He had to do it remotely. But I was quite shocked, actually. The guy who did the kind of warm-up bit, who is now currently serving a jail sentence for tax evasion, was linking getting healed, but giving money. And the entire spiel that he gave was that if you want your breakthrough, you've got to break through the barriers you're putting in your mind, telling you not to give beyond what you think you should give. And by the way, here's a slip where you can put your credit card number on and tell us how much you can give. So he was manipulating people into believing they could get healed from sickness by giving more than they felt comfortable with and donating by credit card. And that's about as despicable as you can get. I mean, we've got a bunch of ill people who may not know very much about the gospel. You're linking them getting healed with giving huge sums of money, potentially on credit card. And that was at Benny Hinn's meeting. As I said, that gentleman now is behind bars at the moment. So it kind of says it all, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many that have similar prosecutions over the way in which they teach this. And for me, it all comes back to this. If it's all about money, is it all about religion? The two don't really mix that well. And so when you have a person that's pushing, give me your money, and even, you know, that problem becomes even further amplified when you have these people, these small ministers who are preaching the old covenant tithing system. They're doing the same thing, just on a much smaller scale. And so you have to ask the question, well, is God really in this? Because their focus appears to be money whenever God doesn't work like this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just recently, I got a letter from one of these ministries. It did go in the bin, I have to say. But he was saying how, you know, times are really tough and people are struggling, but you've really got to make sure that you carry on tithing for God to bless you. And it's like, how could you do that? You know you're writing to people that are struggling. You've said it. He should be saying, I've got millions of dollars. I will give you some money to help you. It just makes me so angry.
It never seems to go in that direction.
It never seems to go in that direction.
I one of these days, I'd love to walk up to one of these guys and give them a tenth of my vegetable plot and see how they react.
Well, I would love to go and ask them where they're giving their tithes, because, you know, if it is for Christian people to give tithes to them, well, where does their tithing go? I have seen examples of ministers who do it properly, and they do the old covenant tithing system, but there are poor people in the church, and they do help the poor. So I can't say that 100% of ministers are like this, but I can say that I have seen a heck of a lot of them that were driving Cadillacs while some of the parishioners could not even afford a car, and they're taking the tithe, and they're bettering themselves, I guess is the best way to put it, whenever other people in their church is suffering. So I'm one of the few Americans who believe that the entire church system should be taxed, because if you did, you wouldn't have all of these people who are entering the ministry just to dodge taxes. And I think that's a huge part of the problem here. So anyway, it appears to be about money, and especially when you get into the prosperity gospel and these movements like God TV that are pushing this notion that if you give God some money, he's going to do X, Y, or Z for you. It is pure deception in its finest.
Changing the subject a bit, one of the things that I feel bad about is the fact that when I was in it, I was giving prophecies and all this sort of stuff and trying to get people to come along and join in, not realizing that I was being as bad, well, not as, quite as bad, I don't think, but not realizing that I was going to have a detrimental effect on people's faith. I mean, one lady left the church that we were in and went there, and now she doesn't go anywhere, having had an experience at New Frontiers. And I don't know where her faith is. And I just feel bad that, you know, we came up with the idea for her to come to that church, you know, and the prophecies and things I had. You know, it's like, was that from God or was it me? Or what? It is that whole deconstruction of, you know, asking God for forgiveness if I did sort of lead people astray. and sort of detangling situate of things in my mind. And sometimes you just can't work it out, and you just have to put it to one side.
It's hard. I have had experiences whenever I was in the movement that could be called spiritual. I no longer call them spiritual, but they could have been called spiritual. And it isn't that I no longer believe in all of it, but there is a lot of deception, but there is also the situation that is a human problem, where when people are in a movement and they're all in a groupthink mindset, they begin thinking alike, acting alike, doing the same things. And so for me, there's a psychological question to it. When people have these things that appear to be spiritual, were they really, or were they just part of the group and acting like this? So I carry guilt just simply because of my family name. My family attracted people into this. But over time, I came to release that guilt, because every single person is on their own journey. And one of the hardest things for me to accept, whenever I started working with people who were escaping, and I had to go through the deconstruction, it was the hardest thing I ever went through. Whenever I see somebody else deconstruct and they go a different pathway than I've chosen, I never dissuade them from the path that they choose. Because if you believe in a God who is all powerful and a God who is leading those who are his people, you have to believe that whatever is the path that they're on is for a reason, and that God can lead them back. It's not my decision to lead them in or out in a certain way. Now, I can support them. I can you know, be good to them in the way that the Bible says to be good. So that's what I do. But I came to release that guilt, because everybody is on their own journey, and who they become is based on the experiences that they have, and not all of the experiences that mold a person's framework and their outlook, not all of them are good experiences.
Yeah. Another thing I've had to come to terms with is what I thought was getting really close to God through the music and through worshipping. And I feel like I've lost an intimacy with what I thought was God, but I think actually it was more of a high induced by the worship music and by the repetitiveness. But I used to strive to go to these conferences to sort of get that high, and I didn't realize I was doing that. I didn't realize I was that's what it was. It's really hard. And you feel like, well, God, I don't need to have this emotional high to talk to you, but I miss it.
Yeah. Well, and that's the real hard part, because the false religion associates the emotion with the God. In other words, you have to have the emotion to receive the God, which isn't biblical at all. And it's the reverse, actually. If God comes, it should give you the emotion, and not vice versa. But worse than that, I'm a musician, and I still have not overcome this. We were singing songs that had bad theology in them. And some of the songs that I felt closest to God in had really, really bad theology. And so I look at the manipulation that can be done through music, and I have come to the point in my life, I almost do not listen to gospel music at all. And that's all I played for years and years. I would rather listen to a CD by Sting than I would a gospel CD. And part of it, you know, after having been burned once, I was manipulated by the music. I don't want to be burned again. So I chose not to, and that may change in the future. I don't know. But for right now, I just avoid it altogether.
Yeah, I find the same thing. I rarely listen to it now. Because I think, yeah, like you said, if you know, I'm a musician too, and you know the tricks that you use to make something sound spiritual, the repetition of the choruses, the suspended chords that go on forever, and it is a formula, really, in terms of the music. It is. It, it, think that's what it works. It does work in people's minds.
It's really funny when you think about it, because there is a mathematical formula to making a person feel like they're receiving God. And as a musician, you can recognize it. The average person doesn't see it, but I know exactly what you're talking about. There are chord progressions that I can make somebody get into a religious high. And if I know how to do this through a formula, is it really God? I don't believe so.
No.
And like you said, I agree. It makes it very hard to go back and listen to the music, because it does make you, it also brings back the memories of when you were being manipulated. And the last thing you want to do is be reminded of that. But also because you're very, you know, as you said, you once burned, you don't want to get burned again by it, kind of thing. So it is difficult to listen to it again. And unfortunately, a lot of Christian music is in that bracket. There are a few that aren't, and they tend to be the ones I listen to. But the worship music, some of it, particularly coming out of some of the well-known ministries that have had problems recently, no, I'd probably avoid that.
I used to think, what's the point of secular music? Music should just be there for God. And not realizing. So if I do listen to music, it's to old hymns now.
Yeah.
Because God's very straightforward. There's no big mystery. He wants to be known. There's no sort of, you have to go to this conference or behave like this or do that, and maybe he'll reveal something to you. He wants to be known. He sent us his word. And the old hymns, usually, most of them, just tell a story about Jesus and about God. And it is about God. And it's not about how I am in relation to God, if you see what I mean. It's not all about me and my feelings and what God... it's a difficult one, because it's so subtle, because you want to acknowledge what God's done for you, because he loves us so much, but you don't want to be concentrating on yourself all the time. You want to be glorifying God, but then you don't want to get on the high, and it's like...
Well, thank you very much for coming on here and sharing your story with me. Like I said, I've had a few others who were in the same group that are sending me information, and it's a little bit overwhelming to see how far and wide that this weird framework has spread and into all of these churches. But if you could give some advice to somebody who is in one of these types of groups, what advice would you give them?
Read your Bible. Really read your Bible. Don't just do the one verse and then 10 pages of sermon. Get into your Bible and know your Bible, and talk to other people and question things. And if anyone out there is feeling like they need to talk by email with us, we're quite happy to be put in touch feel like they need to discuss anything, or if we can offer any help.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure many people are going to find encouragement, you know, from having similar experiences that you have. I know I was, because we musicians connect, so I immediately connected with you, but I'm encouraged by it, and I hope some other people are. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can contact us on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the NAR, read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and soon Audible.